Hi, I'm Judy Stewart, and this is Unpaused, a podcast for women wanting to reinvent their careers after a break from work. While visiting Sicily recently, I chanced upon meeting Carolina Goodman, who, with her husband, former Italian television journalist Piero De Pasquale, are the creative forces behind Manima World in Palermo, a digital atelier of fine, hand-embroidered home linens and ready-to-wear. If there are two words that make my heart beat faster, they are hand-embroidered. When Carolina told me it was her mission to preserve and empower the embroidresses of Sicily, I was in. This mission bows to the centuries-old reputation of Sicily for its exquisite ecclesiastical and what they call dowry embroideries, as much as it is about women's social and economic revival in Italy's south, where their educational opportunities have been so subdued that female unemployment hovers around a shocking 70%. One of the many things that intrigued me was Carolina's background, not as a textile careerist, but as an economist who grew up in Brazil and later Germany with her parents, both classical musicians. While nothing in her professional CV might have suggested what was to come, Carolina credits her mother in particular for her creative sympathies and strong eye, which together and with seismic intent catapulted her out of the corporate world and into Sicily's ancient artisanal culture. She turned her back on executive life in the pharmaceuticals industry to found Manima with Piero, moving to Palermo to begin their important work on what they call regenerative luxury together. Carolina, welcome to Unpause.
Thank you for this nice introduction, Judith. I couldn't have done it any better.
I'd like to start with Manima and then go back to your working life before it all began. In simple terms, what is it about Sicily, its embroidery, and the women who practice it that really attracted you?
There are many things to it, Judith. It's actually an interesting question. One thing is that the embroidery in Sicily is so eclectic. Sicily is a melting pot of cultures. Many people may not know that Sicily was conquered by 26 different peoples, by different nations and cultures. Before we talk, we consider them nations, of course, you know, from Phoenicians to Greek to Normans to Spanish to Turkish. Everybody came through Sicily and left something. So embroidery in Sicily is over 1,000 years old, and it clearly reflects this melting pot. When you look at the some of the embroideries, typically these pull threads, you can see the architecture of the cathedral in Palermo, which was built in 1200, so more than 800 years ago. And you can see that the embroidery reflects the structure of the cathedral. And there are so many influences that you see in these embroideries. Another thing that I found interesting is when I founded Manima, I wanted to do something with and for women. And I found out that embroidery had typically been masculine in Sicily until the late 17th century, even 18th century, because the women were only allowed to embroider at home what was considered less precious. So dowries were considered less precious, whilst the men were going to embroider tapestry. They embroidered gobelins. So there are palazzi in Sicily, like Palazzo Mirto in Palermo, which I hope you will see next time you come here, where you find more than 100 square meters embroidered with silk by men.
Okay.
So I found it very interesting to go back to the roots, to see how we can preserve and recover the art, but also elevate the level of what the women were used to do to a much more artistic perspective. So there are different aspects to that.
The statistic of 70% unemployment for women in Sicily is truly sobering. Why is it so high? And what do you feel you're doing to address that?
Yes. I mean, 70% is really a number that is hard to believe when you talk about the European country, right? I think there are several reasons to that. structural, so infrastructure. Sicily is an island, and Sicily is not very well connected to the continent, to Italy, so let me say, put it that way. In these little villages, typically women did not have access in the past to a high-level education. The newer generations, they are all going to a high school. Many are going to study, but still you don't have a very high percentage of women who go through academic education. In the past, you had a very high number of women who would not go beyond the fourth grade. So not even so elementary school. If you look at around 60, 70 year old women, there are many in these little villages who never went beyond fourth or fifth grade. So you have a lack of access to education in the past, which was also cultural, because women were not supposed to study, especially in the rural areas in where Sicily is made of agriculture, where women had to help in the fields. They had to help in agriculture. They had to stay home and feed the family. That was their main reason to be. So you see there are historic reasons to that. There are structural reasons to that, geographical reasons to that, because Sicily has a very difficult geography. It's not very easy to get from a little village to a big city. It may be a long bus ride. There is no good train connection in Sicily. So it's made very hard for women to get access to a high quality education into high quality profession. Those girls who have reached that, and we have many Sicilians, usually leave the island. They go away. So you have many Sicilians who work in Milan, who work outside Italy, other countries, highly qualified people who work in research, science. That's a very small percentage. While you still have that large percentage of women who traditionally were not supposed to go out and study. So what are we doing with the embroidery? Of course, I cannot resolve that problem, you know, because it's a huge problem. 70% is a huge number. I can contribute in a small way to giving women jobs in a very transparent way, doing what they have loved doing for their whole life, which is embroidery. And I can try to get them to transfer it to other generations. So to teach younger girls who maybe do not want or cannot have an academic profession, I can help learning something which can be a nice source of income in transparent conditions and which they can do from wherever they are. That was the idea behind that, that you don't need to take them to a manufacturing site, which would again have made life harder for them, so they can manage their time.
I understand that as soon as they have to move out of the village, it's very difficult. So the counterpoint to that is that they do their sewing, their embroidery in their domestic environment, in their households, perhaps they join together in their community. Is that the idea?
Yes. That's their creative life. It's not only their creative life, it's their social life also. So it's more, many of them, they sit outside. You know, we have a very nice climate in Sicily. So many of them sit outside and embroider in the gardens, even in the factory outside or wherever they are. They can sit together, they can chat, they can talk, they have conversation, they see each other. Embroidery had a very important social role in the past because, you know, many of these women, they did not have any other social life besides their own family. So I see how happy the women are when they are together.
Yeah.
But there is at the same time a balance about them being able to be together on certain days, but then being able to do their work whenever they can throughout the day. So they don't embroider for 8 hours a day. They embroider for the time they can, compatibly with their families, with other duties that they may have. And that makes it much easier for them.
And may I talk for a moment about this dowry embroidery? Because that's an alluring concept to me. And obviously there is part of that will have filtered into your collection of homewares, you know, household linen and the like.
Yes, they were very highly regarded in terms of value. And even a very poor family would not let their daughter get married without an adequate dowry. Of course, the richer, the wealthier a family was, the richer the dowry was. And the dowry used to be, in the Renaissance, it became something extremely wealthy and rich. If you look even at the Borgias and all the important people in Renaissance would have incredible dowries that were made of a very precise number of pieces. And the wealthier you were, the more pieces it would have. It would have sleepwear, so it would have nightgowns, it would have bed sheets, it would have everything that you would have to, if you have to be very elegant, you would have everything like gloves and very beautiful socks, you know, made of laces. There's a museum here that where I saw lace made pieces of dowries, which are amazing. Mm. They were really amazing. They were made for royal families, for the court in France, for the courts in Italy at that time. The dowry stayed the tradition for a long time until the 80s. When the globalization hit, that kind of tradition slowly went away. What? Because, of course, with globalization, all of a sudden, it was so attractive to buy things in other places and not locally handmade. Too many families couldn't afford that anymore. So the price of the dowry usually is so high that many families started preparing dowries for their daughter when they were born, so that it would be ready when they got married. But these are all family traditions, and with the family traditions changing with the society, of course, also the tradition of the dowry change. We think that today the dowry can be a very interesting thing in a very modernized and contemporaneous way because it can tell a story. The dowry was something that a daughter would bring from her old family into her new world. Sometimes these worlds were completely separate because she had to abandon completely her old world to go into somewhere new. And she was in a sometimes hostile situation. And what she had was what she brought from her family. It had a very important symbolic value, also beyond the material value that it had. So the dowry is something that is highly symbolic. And it can, today, I think it would be interesting to reestablish that family bond that a dowry used to be, because it can be something you can collect year by year. You can collect it every year, can add a piece. And I think it gained something. It's meant to be passed to the next generation. So it's meant to last. And these are not pieces which get ruined by washing, you know, they stay forever. That's a very interesting concept in the fast world.
And I suppose I'll come to this later, but I suppose that's at sort of the heart of the luxury that it represents, that every piece is handmade and made to such a high standard, made to last and made to hand down from generation to generation.
Absolutely. Luxury in the past used to be that, right? Mm. So when luxury was born, it was when luxury had luxury since the beginning. I mean, if you look at ancient Egypt, look at the Chinese dynasties, luxury is something that humanity has lived for since existed, whatever luxury means for each of us, because luxury per se is something that you do not necessarily need, but it makes your life much more beautiful and nicer. So with mass luxury that we have today, which is so accessible, it became mass products and quality has really suffered a lot. And most of the big luxury companies, they have, in order to fulfill the request, they have to produce in low-wage countries in conditions which are certainly not ideal. So the true concept of luxury, look at the Fabergé egg, right? Mm. Fabergé used to make the eggs for the family of the Tsar, and they became something so symbolic because these ages, if you look at an egg, Fabergé egg today, this is going to last forever. I think even when we are not going to be there, everybody will remember Fabergé eggs. Mm. So that was, the luxury was very different. Mm. I think if we want to be sustainable, we want luxury, but it has to be regenerative. Luxury cannot be extracted. It cannot be exploitative as it has been in the past decades. It has to rethink itself. And it starts from the purely handmade, but purely handmade at the right conditions, not paying people a dollar per hour or less, 20 cents per hour in Bangladesh or in Pakistan or somewhere else.
So would it be true to say, Carolina, that these embroideries that these women in the villages made, would they represent a form of luxury for which Sicily then became famous, uniquely became famous? Is that, you know, at the essence of luxury, really what they were about?
That's a difficult question. Now, you have embroidery in different regions in Italy. Sicily is probably the region where embroidery is oldest. So it's it really dates back to the beginning of the 1100s. You had Federico II, Frederick II, who was a highly illuminated person. And in his court, embroidery became something very important. And certainly it was considered a luxury. So it was exported from Sicily first to Tuscany and to other regions and then to France. So yes, at a certain point, I think you are right, because it is a very typical local luxury. It was considered luxury. It was not considered luxury anymore at a certain time, period of time. You know, it was especially what the women did at home was not considered luxury. Mm. And you still have lots of embroidery which are very simple, which are very, very normal, nothing very special, very actually, yes, not very important. And then you have incredible embroidery in some places where you never would believe you can find that. And then you have certain small villages which are famous for a certain point of stitch, for a certain type of embroidery, lace or so. So it's very interesting. But there are more of less that also in other places of Italy. So I would not say that it is a pure Sicilian privilege.
Well, let me talk about you then, Carolina. It's not that long since you left your career at Merck Pharmaceutical as an executive there behind. If you sort of cast your mind back, how long had you been thinking about leaving that career and pursuing something quite different, or for that matter, pursuing the whole endeavor that you're involved in now?
I would say for quite some time. I think that most of us, I would dare to say that most of us throughout their career has moments where you think that you might want to do something different, right? I think that these moments started to concentrate at a certain point. Mm. And I think they start to concentrate the higher you get in your career. I did have the impression the more similar everything I had to do looked like. It's when you are in a certain point and you have to look only at numbers and you have to make things happen according to a growth scheme that is intrinsic to a multinational corporate company.
So let me just interrupt you there for a moment, Carolina. I should ask you to describe your role. What was your position before you left the company?
Before I left, I was responsible for the oncology business for 11 countries in Merck. Mm. And it was a highly responsible position, you know, and I had to take care. It was a turnover of 250 million and 250 million that you have to grow year by year. Mm. And you have to chase these countries and you have to understand all the different cultures because, you know, countries, Scandinavia is deeply different compared to Israel or to Greece or to Spain or to Portugal. Each country has different situations. So it was really about how do you get each country to grow and to grow and to grow. and especially working in pharmaceutical company, growing means that people have to prescribe more drugs that the company produces, right?
Mm.
And I mean, there is only so much more that something can be prescribed more. And that means that you have to take it away from other competitors. And then you have to be completely convinced that what your company is selling is really better than what the other companies are selling, because you're talking about deadly sick people. You do not want to really sell something that you are not deeply convinced about. But in pharmaceutical industry in particular, everybody is convinced that what they are doing is the best, you know, because, and rightly so, because of course, pharmaceutical companies, I really do not want to speak badly about them, because they finance research. Without pharmaceutical companies, there would not be research, because governments don't have the money to finance that. Without pharmaceutical companies, there would not be so much progress in the treatment of so many diseases. Still, for me, at a certain point, I did not find a deeper sense to what I was doing. I had been looking for a deeper sense. You know, I grew up in a family which was very eclectic with art and music and so many stimuli. And I didn't find that stimulus anymore in pharmaceutical industry, which doesn't mean that there isn't. I didn't find it for myself.
If you, having decided to leave and have a change, can you think of any sort of concrete moments where you had a sense of clarity about, you know, the task ahead? Was there any step you took that helped you to crystallize that decision and make the leap?
There was one moment that I will never forget. I was coming back from a business meeting in Tel Aviv, and I was in a plane. I didn't remember where I was coming back from, because I had had so many flights during the same week and so many different appointments. I couldn't distinguish anymore. When I was in the hotels, I didn't remember my room number. I didn't know where I was, because I would simply wipe it out of my memory. And I thought, on that day when I came back from Tel Aviv, I thought, oh my God, I think it's too much. Mm. There's something. And I was suffering of chronic back pain at that time. It was really getting so tough, and it was a lot was psychological stress. It was not only all the flights and back and forth with your suitcase and packing at 3 o'clock in the morning to get on the first airplane, you know, and go from Stockholm to Brussels and from Brussels to Tel Aviv and from Tel Aviv to Athens or whatever. It was just, what am I doing? What is the sense of that? And that was the moment, you know, when it really hit me. And when it hit me, I took the decision very fast.
Mm-hmm.
From there, I took it really fast. It took me only very few weeks. I talked with my husband, and he very much encouraged me in that.
Mm.
And he said, there are so many things you can do. And I said, yes, but I don't know what.
Mm.
He said, do what your heart tells you. And then we decide. Then you take a decision. But now you feel like you have to leave. And that's what I did.
And so why embroidery then? What was the connection there?
The connection was, my husband had already left his career in television as a journalist. So we decided then, let's see what we can do together. We want to do something meaningful with that part of our lives that all of a sudden we had. We had been very privileged to have nice jobs, to be very well paid. So let's see what we can do to give back some of that. And we started studying. So for a whole year, we did nothing else but study. We would invite people just to talk to, I mean, whatever philosophers or economists or politicians, so just to see where was the world going. And we had thought that working with the handmade was something that we felt very close to us. We like beauty a lot. We like art. We like beauty. We like the handmade. And then we studied, and I said, okay, if we do handmade, let's find something which has also social role. That gets back to embroidery, which I told you before.
Mm.
So embroidery is not like working leather in a place. It's not like working glass. making glass. Embroidery has something which is very connecting, that's stitching together. It's almost like a thread of life. It's something that is so different to embroidery compared to many other handwork.
And Carolina, did you see it as an obstacle at all that you were not a professional embroideress? Did you feel at any point that you were at a disadvantage there?
No, I did not feel I was at a disadvantage. First of all, what I learned to embroider. So I had some very expert teachers, and I wanted to know, of course, how much time it takes to do certain things. I wanted to feel the sense of what it means to embroider. And I found it very meditative and very beautiful. I think it was better that I wasn't an embroiderer, because I could start that business looking at it from a pure business point of view also. In order to make that successful, I had to see if that had a market, if there was interest for the embroidery, and how I could make it much more interesting for a broader audience. So if I had been an embroiderer, I don't think I would have been able to do that. So It's bringing together my background and also some of the creativity that I had in family. You know, I grew up a lot of creativity. My mother was extremely creative. My father was extremely creative. I did feel it was an obstacle at all.
And so with Manima, just to give a visual picture of what I saw in your beautiful studio, what would I see if I came to Manima?
Well, you did not have the opportunity to see the women working. But of course, when you come, you can see the women working, which is very interesting because it's not like working in a manufacturing site. You know, it's these women, it's a very creative process. It's from the design to putting the stitch on the fabric, choosing the fabrics together, choosing the kind of stitches that we are going to use, choosing the threads. There are so many different threads, the colors, the beauty of this whole thing, and seeing the product be born. Yeah. I think that is something which is very thrilling. It's something that usually you cannot, you know, you get, go to a shop, you have a ready product that you buy and that's, it's there. So we try to involve our, whenever it's possible, we send them pictures of how their products were made, you know, and just videos. And it's exciting, you know, because it's a very nice atmosphere that you get into. You don't feel like you are in a manufacturing site or in a shop. This is very different.
Yes.
It's more a cultural place.
Very important collaboration on foot with a Japanese-American artist, Kazumi Yoshida.
Yes.
Would you like to tell the story of that collaboration?
Oh, Kazumi is, I call him our Japanese gentleman. I think Kazumi is one of the most amazing people I've met. He came to Palermo last year because he had an exhibition there. It was called Utopia. So we went to the opening of the exhibition, and then we were invited to a dinner where Kazumi was sitting close to us, and we started a conversation, which was the most lovely conversation you can imagine. And eventually he asked me what we were doing in Sicily, and I told him about that. He said nothing. He listened very carefully, and we took him back to his hotel. And a week later, he wrote me an email, said, "I looked up what you are doing. I like it a lot. We can collaborate." And it was such an amazing moment, you know. It was amazing. And since then, we have started collaborating, and we are now expanding that collaboration. We are going to present a connection with him in Dubai in November. And that connection is also going to be completed by carpets made by Jaipur Rugs. Jaipur Rugs is another amazing reality. You know, they give work to more than 40,000 women in India, and they were our inspiration from the beginning. And now they're official partners. So we have become official partners with Jaipur Rugs. And so they are going to make carpets with Kazumi Yoshida's design. And we make the home linens with the same designs. And we are going to present the joint collection, which is really beautiful. So it's amazing. Working with Kazumi is a joy. It's really a pure joy. I think that collaboration takes us to a next higher level. actually, we make a big jump because we always, Pira and I, we always had thought that we wanted to connect embroidery to contemporaneous art. With Kazumi, we are making that jump. Okay, so we are just doing what we had always dreamed about. We wanted to connect that. And that makes embroidery so much more interesting because it opens horizons that are limitless. Because you really can do that then with embroidery, you can do things that you would not have thought about. You know, you can do incredible furniture. You can do most amazing. There is no limit to imagination when you put it together with contemporaneous art, especially when you have an artist like Kazumi Yoshida, who is also, by the way, collaborating with Hermes a lot. He has been collaborating with them for a long time. His creativity is so fascinating, so full of joy. His colors are beautiful. I think that it's also for the embroiderers, they feel pure joy when they embroider that. It's so different compared to everything they have done before. For us, it's opening a new horizon and a new market because that is really interesting for collectors. It's very interesting for people who love art. Mm. And all of a sudden, it's functional art. So you can really have these beautiful pieces in your home without buying a painting from Kazumi, but you can have a beautifully made thing by him. Mm. It's really nice.
And so, Caroline, if you looked back over your career, starting as an economist, but having grown up in a very creative family, and look at where you are now. Do you have any regrets in terms of the career transition?
No, I have no regret. Not at all. I think, you know, everything has its time. And I enjoyed my career, certainly until a certain point. And I would not regret at all. I don't regret at all having less. I feel very happy about doing that. We have very difficult moments, you know, when you are an entrepreneur, there are sleepless nights, and the salary is not just something which is a given. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to earn the money very hard. And especially when you have employees, you have a big responsibility, a responsibility on your shoulders. Mm-hmm. So that is, of course, something when you're still in this growth phase, we are still a small thing and we are growing slowly, but organically. There are definitely difficult moments, but I never, never, my husband or I regretted a thing.
Oh, well, congratulations, Carolina. It's a beautiful story. I'm so pleased I met you. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You've really made my day today.
Thank you, Judith.
You can probably tell how captivated I am by the story of the embroideresses of Sicily. But as well as telling that story, Carolina also shared a framework for transitioning from one career to another, which is helpful. Step one for Carolina was deciding to find something she could do together with Piero. They both felt their careers had been good to them and wanted to give something back. Together, they took a year to fully consider different ideas. That meant getting out and talking to people from all walks of life and studying different concepts as they presented themselves. Taking handmade as their chief parameter, they soon settled on Sicilian embroidery for its cultural significance, its intriguing history, its potential as a regenerative luxury product, and as a vehicle for social and economic rehabilitation. It ticked almost all the boxes they'd identified. Carolina brought everything she knew from business and her upbringing to the endeavour: financial rigour, marketing expertise, and imagination. Meanwhile, she learned how to embroider herself to better understand its complexities. An unexpected bonus was discovering both its meditative and companionable qualities. The final goal was to eventually align the endeavour with contemporary art. On the back of a chance encounter, Yoshido Katsumi got involved and the project was brought full circle. The collaboration transformed the embroidery design to the delight of both Carolina and the embroideresses, opened doors to new clients, collectors, and other collaborators, and delivered many benefits to the business and its two founders. Its success makes perfect sense. I'd like to thank Carolina for giving me a glimpse into her world. It was wonderful. If you'd like to see Manama at work, look at it on Instagram at Manama World. I'm Judy Stewart, and this is Unpaused. Until next time, farewell.